Tonight on Arena, up for review on TV, The Terminalist, Dark Wolf, Katrina, Come Hell or High Water, and The Guest, plus albums from CMAT, Sabrina Carpenter, and The Hives. Now, you can contact us on 51551. You can email us to arena@rte.ie. And we're on Instagram too, at @RTE_arena. Now, on tonight's TV reviews, The Terminalist, Dark Wolf. It's an action thriller on Prime Video. It follows Ben Edwards, played by Taylor Kitsch, a Navy SEAL, transitioning to a CIA paramilitary operative. This is a prequel to the 2022 series The Terminalist and explores Edwards' moral descent and darker impulses in a gritty plot. Chris Pratt also stars as a fellow Navy SEAL, James Reese. We've got Katrina, Come Hell or High Water. It's a three-part Netflix docuseries, executively produced by Spike Lee, and it revisits New Orleans 20 years after Hurricane Katrina, a Category 5 storm, pounded the city, causing devastation. And the series blends survivor stories with archival footage and recounts the systematic failures that occurred at the time. And finally, The Guest. It's a four-part thriller that begins on BBC One next Monday, and it follows the toxic relationship that develops between the wealthy businesswoman Fran and her cleaner Rhea. And Rhea admired Fran's confidence and status, but when Fran gives her advice, it sparks a shocking event that entangles both of them in a manipulative game of cat and mouse. And I'm joined in studio by Jen Gannon and Chris Wasser. Guys, it's lovely to have you here. Hello. Now, first up tonight, we're going to look at Prime Video's prequel to The Terminalist with The Terminalist, Dark Wolf. Chris, we're into the macho world of Navy SEALs here. Tell me, what is the premise?
It's a very macho world. Everyone here, I don't know how many times the guys use the word brother. It's all about army bros. The Terminalist in 2022 was a series of Chris Pratt at the centre. It was based on a novel by Jack Carr, who's a former Navy SEAL himself, turned author. And it was about a Navy SEAL member, Pratt was playing the lead, who he's on some covert mission. His team is ambushed. They're all killed. He thinks that maybe something went wrong that his superiors knew about before going into it. He comes home to face further tragedy. And when he comes home and talks about the fact that he might have been set up, he confides in his best friend, who's a former Navy SEAL named Ben Edwards, played by Taylor Kitsch, and he's now a CIA agent. And I think there was some question marks about who was this guy and why did he leave the Navy SEALs to become that CIA agent. So because The Terminalist was so popular, I think everyone's kind of gone back to the drawing board and said, Ben Edwards, let's tell his story. So his story is that, you know, in 2015, based in Mosul, Iraq, he actually took Reese, that's Chris Pratt's character, and a few other men out on this mission to find a man who attacked their base, their training base, where they were training with Iraqi security forces. And he wants to find the man responsible for a bomb attack that claimed the life of his friend. Now, his superiors are saying, you can't do that. This guy is an asset, but he doesn't listen. He executes this man, and instead of being sent to prison, he's sent home where, you know, surprise, surprise, someone enters the equation and says, okay, you're no longer a Navy SEAL. Why don't you come for work for us? We're the CIA. We do things a little bit differently.
Okay, and do we need to have watched The Terminalist to get the concept of this?
I think you could actually step into this as a newcomer. There's plenty of background there. You know, there's a reminder of who Pratt is, of what this world involves. At no point, like, I watched about half of the Terminalist, about as much as I could actually endure of that series 3 years ago. And certainly starting this, there was no point where I was pausing it and asking any questions. So I think it doesn't do a lot of things right, but it does explain itself well enough if you're a newcomer in this world.
Okay, right. And people, Jen, may know Chris Pratt. Okay, yeah. He's been the star of so many franchises, right, including Guardians of the Galaxy, and he was in the Jurassic World movie as well. But who is he, and why do you think he's such a favorite with producers?
I mean, I don't know why. I never saw the first go round of this in 2022, mainly because it starred Chris Pratt, and I think a little Pratt goes a long way. And I think with him being a star, he's quite bland, I would have to say. And I think this is the type of show for him because it's about American imperialism. It's about American exceptionalism. And that there are things that they hold dear and they're probably coming back into fashion now with the way it is over there politically. Mm-hmm. And I think they found in him their star. That if you're looking at, say, shows that are conservatively bent, something like Yellowstone. That is the kind of resurgence we're seeing of America, American as the hero of the world. You know, it's almost like superhero style in that way. And I think that's what they're finding in a star like Chris Pratt. But thankfully, he is relegated to the sidelines almost in this series. And it's really looking at Taylor Kitsch's Ben Edwards, who I think is a much more interesting character with a lot more layers and a lot more depth. And I will say, even for all my problems with this show, Taylor Kitsch, his performance, I mean, he's this wounded anti-hero. We like that. We like, you know, he's good at giving us gritty. People would know him from, you know, Riggins in Friday Night Lights, and a lot of people love that show and hold that show very dear. But he's never seemed to have had the launch, the career that he should have maybe subsequently. And I think they're investing a lot in him and investing a lot in his character, even though I think a lot of the time he looks like he could be in a Pearl Jam, like reverse band. There's something very Eddie Vedder about him, which and I was wondering, can you get away with that hair with the job?
When you're in the army.
I don't think so. Get rid of those sideburns. So he's he's a bit of a loose cannon, as you can tell from what Chris has said and someone up there. So he's the more interesting side of this show, which is to me quite, you know, strange propaganda. Like it's full of extrajudicial killings that are, you know, they're a plus point to them, that they could go out and do this kind of mission, which I found unsettling.
Okay, well, do you know what? Why don't we give people a little flavour of what Dark Wolf sounds like? Here's a clip of Raph, played by Tom Hopper, and he tells Chris Pratt's character, Reese, and Ben Edwards, played by Taylor Kitsch, of his plan to get revenge on Al Jabouri.
I've been talking with Mo. ISF have intel that ISIS weapons are being stored in the neighborhoods on the outskirts of Mosul. It's next up in the operations log. It's in retaliation for the bombing. That's our way back inside, boys. We roll in with ISF, then split off to Al Jabouri's compound. If we can expose him as an asset, ISIS will kill him for us.
Burn him.
Burn him.
And fucking burn him.
Now, a lot of this I found a little bit cringy to watch. Mm. And as you said, you mentioned, if I heard the word brother again, that's kind of how I felt. But if the writer of the novel was a former Navy SEAL, does it give the story a little bit more credibility?
Maybe. Maybe when it comes to the dialogue and just in terms of like mission setups, maybe all of that stuff is authentic. I don't know. Thankfully, I've never been in that position. But I think the best thing that the show has going for it, as Jen said, is Taylor Kitsch's performance. Because again, I'm not a huge fan of Chris Pratt either. I don't usually agree with him. But I agreed with him this week when he was talking about the fact that he was at a screening of Dark Wolf. And he says his agent was at a screening of Dark Wolf too. And they both had a discussion afterwards and said, this is better than the last time. And I agree. But at the same time, I do want to say to listeners, saying Dark Wolf is better than the previous Terminal List is a little bit like saying Alien Earth, which we reviewed here recently, is the best alien tale in 20 years. That's an astonishingly low bar. Okay. So we do have to remember that. But there are parts of the series that are very well made, very well acted by Taylor Kitsch, an actor who I feel like we've been trying to make Taylor Kitsch a thing for about 20 years. And that guy has had some unfortunate luck on the big screen and the small screen between John Carter and the second terrible season of True Detective. But he does deliver a strong performance here. He makes this watchable. And I think if you were to tune out, and even if you were to just listen to that clip there, if you just watch the first hour of this series, you might think, oh, it's all set at war. It's all Call of Duty. But if you watch the second hour, it goes full on James Bond. I started off not liking it, but then I started to appreciate just the boneheadedness of it and just its ambition, the silliness. Yeah, I started to like it a bit more.
Because, you know, Jen was mentioned there, we're in a world of America the Brave, you know, versus Iraq. And is there a nostalgia for that old conflict?
Completely.
You know, it's a time of good versus bad, isn't
it? This is it. And you know exactly who is the other, the monsters at the door. And I found that very uncomfortable, especially when on the battlefield, it seems like these men can do whatever they like in pursuit of a larger goal. And there's even this bizarre storyline subplot with Luke Hemsworth's character. There is another Hemsworth. They're like the third
one. Well, actually, he was the first one, I think.
He's the first one. But his character, there's a creepy sexual harassment storyline with him. And it's kind of brushed under the carpet as it goes on because for the good of the cause. Mm. And the cause is, you know, anti the enemy. And I understand as it goes on, it's trying to explain why we shouldn't have these gunslingers, you know, do whatever they want. And it might not be a great idea, but it, for the bulk of it, it does show how actually fun that can be as well, which I found disturbing, mm-hmm. I have to say. And I feel like it's, you know, I've seen critics saying that it's clever and it has, you know, it's more clever than it should be. And I don't think so. I found it a bit mindless. The action sequences, I found they looked like a shoot 'em up game. It was very empty to me without that characterization from Taylor Kitsch, and difficult to watch in places.
It's funny because I got that gamer vibe off it as well. And also there was like a vibe of Team America off it as well.
Very much.
But I have to say, Chris, towards the end of the episode, I went, ooh, I might watch the second episode, where I didn't feel that the whole way through. Mm. So you're telling me to continue, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. I agree with Jen. I mean, I don't think there's anything clever about this series. It's interesting. The first one was so terribly reviewed that Jack Carr, the author, actually came out and said, we didn't make this show for the critics. And I thought, what does that even mean? So I don't think it has good ideas, but it does have a better cast this time. It makes the clever decision to actually push Pratt to the periphery. I think he actually disappears from an awful lot of the season. He's just sort of even just passing the baton to Taylor. It looks the part in some places. I agree with Jen again, though. It all gets a little too kind of Call of Duty when it comes to the, you know, the shoot 'em up sequences. But there's something there, something very, very small. You have to squint in order to see it.
Okay.
But it's a mild improvement on the first round.
Mm, and I have to say, I agree with you as well about Taylor Kitsch. I do think we need to make him a thing.
Yeah. He's our fetch in human form. Yeah.
So out of five, guys.
I would have given it two, but I'm going to give it a third for kicking Chris Pratt out and bringing in Taylor. So we'll go with three, but I will say approach with caution.
Okay. I'm going to go with two because I feel like it's a dusty relic from another age, and I hope that it will be relegated to that. These type of shows, it needs to be more
and
clever.
No coming back for Chris Pratt, guys.
No, you don't think so.
You can do another Garfield. He's fine. Yeah.
You see, I still have a soft spot for him from Andy in Parks and Rec.
Of course, everybody does. Yeah. But unfortunately, that's not him.
All right. Okay. Well, look, over to Netflix now, and Katrina, come hell or high water. It's a hard-hitting docu-series executively produced by Spike Lee, and it reflects on the devastating hurricane that hit New Orleans 20 years ago. Jen, remind us about this harrowing event and how the producers approached telling this story.
Yeah, so like as we know, it's 20 years ago this week that Hurricane Katrina killed more than 1,800 people, and it displaced nearly 2 million. And it was devastated, obviously, when the storm hit, but also when the levees broke and flooded neighborhoods, causing millions to struggle for their lives amongst civil unrest. And last month, we saw Ryan Coogler produced Hurricane Katrina, his own documentary, A Race Against Time, that was on Disney Plus. And that was a powerful account of this tragedy as well. And it was very resigned, quite reflective. This is a different, at the beginning, it treads a similar line because you're given a thorough account in the first two episodes of how there was no excuse of why a city like New Orleans should be so unprepared for a storm like this. And I think the Ryan Coogler one was more linear, and I think this is something a lot more significant. So the first two parts are smartly told accounts of the tragedy, the first from Gita Ganbir, she directed the documentary The Perfect Neighbor. So she's chronicling the systematic failures that left people stranded. You know, in the Louisiana Superdome, there was 30,000 people there, which you cannot imagine. And then the second is by Samantha Knowles. She did Black and Missing. And she's looking at how, when the levees broke, that given way to, you know, honing in on very specific racist false narratives that were going around about New Orleans being overrun by violent crime, and it very exaggerated about what black on black crime. And then for me, there is this complete tonal shift when you come to the third episode, which I think is the most important, the most searing, and it's when Spike Lee takes over. And in 2006, Spike Lee did a documentary, and it was just a howl of frustration because it was so close to Katrina. It was called When the Levee Broke, and it was about the trauma that the survivors had. So he's bookending almost his previous documentary with this. It's a documentary that could be standalone. It's called God Takes Care of Fools and Babies.
Yeah.
And it starts with this very bracing spoken word poems of two survivors. And to say that this is blistering is an understatement. There is a rawness and a fury that courses through the 90 minutes of this when you're looking at It's unflinching testimony after testimony mm-hmm. after testimony of, it gives you this full picture of complete governmental neglect, the yeah. absolute abject destruction of black communities that mm-hmm. still haven't got their lives back together, a lack of accountability, the gentrification of New Orleans, and just the systematic racism. And it's a complete wake-up call.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack in the three episodes, and let's get a little flavour of that now. This is Fred Johnson. He's a resident of New Orleans, and he's the CEO of the Neighbourhood Development Foundation, and he's talking about the decision taken ahead of the storm hitting.
So, to my understanding, back then, the leaders of the city decided that either you flood these houses or you flood your central business district. So they blew the levees so that the night ward flooded to save the CBD. And the other thing that we can't ever escape is the fact that the lower night ward was all black. You can't be an American, race don't play a factor. Like, white people were able to buy houses in places that didn't flood. But the black people had to buy a house in between the cement company and the railroad track.
I think it's a documentary that basically shows us everything that's wrong with America and everything that's wrong with the class systems in America. And just to go back to it, Chris, the mayor of New Orleans at the time sent out an evacuation order when it was clear the hurricane was going to hit the city. And not many from the Ninth Ward area could get out of New Orleans at such short notice because they didn't have cars. There wasn't enough transport. So they had to go to the Superdome in the city, which you mentioned, Jen, where there was an emergency space for local residents. And it just... it really highlighted, didn't it, the...
yeah, the incompetency, the negligence. Mm. And Ray Nagin, who was the mayor of New Orleans at this time, he doesn't come out of this documentary well,
really,
and rightly so, because there's this extraordinary... this footage will never not be shocking. And there's just extraordinary footage of Ray Nagin saying that they, at the beginning, when they knew the storm was coming, there was a voluntary evacuation, whatever that's supposed to mean. And then when it was almost hitting New Orleans, a mandatory evacuation. But he was forgetting about the people, and he was interviewed on the news, you know, the day before Katrina hit. He was forgetting about the people in the lower night neighborhoods who hadn't got the means or the resources or even the transportation to evacuate themselves. And they just couldn't afford to leave their jobs behind. They couldn't afford to take that chance. And he was talking about how, you know, we need to buddy up and, you know, go to your local church and then get all the communities together and really help one another. But then he disappeared, and he was gone for a couple of days visiting the Superdome when things got bad and then getting out of there again. And the footage also of George Bush flying over 2.5 days into his holidays, deciding that, okay, now I'll actually go fly by and see what's happening here. It's extraordinary footage. And I think this is no disrespect to Geeta Gamvir or Samantha Knowles, both of whom directed the first two installments. They are terrific documentaries in and of themselves, but they do follow the sort of standard Netflix approach where it's talking head explanation footage, talking head news clips. When we get to Spike Lee's film, we've already heard him in the background interviewing people, so you know that he's coming in not just in an executive producer role, but an interviewer and a directorial role. It's a Spike Lee joint, mm-hmm. and he wants you to know that too. And I think that's a good thing, because I thought the stylistic shift was brilliant. The freeze frame introductions, the spoken word poetry that Jen mentioned from Shelton Shakespeare Alexander, a beautiful contribution from Wendell Pierce, an actor and a businessman who is a native of New Orleans. The section where he's talking about his family and going back to his mother and father's house. They were lucky enough to get out. They went back to the house. The house was just completely devastated. And his father is looking up at the walls. And all he says is 20 feet. And he can't believe that the water got that high. It's an extraordinary piece of work, but that final film is something else.
Do you know what we're going to hear from another resident of New Orleans? This is Robert Green. He was a resident of the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans. He decided to evacuate with his elderly mother to the Superdome Stadium, which was set up as an emergency evacuation centre.
We were going to Nashville, but my mother was so sick, she could have died from the road trip. So we went to the Superdome.
Already hundreds of people have made their way to the Superdome, some with suitcases, bottled water and food in hand, others with nothing but the clothes on their back.
Thousands are standing in line right now. Around 10,000 are lined up.
20 to 30,000 people to come inside the Superdome and ride out Katrina. For many, it's their only option.
There were 20,000 people in front of us.
The line stretched for 2 miles just to get in.
And my mother could barely sit up. So I asked the police officer, where could I get my mother in? And she said, go around the back of the Superdome. There was a section called special needs to take people who were, you know, sticky like she was. It wasn't set up. So they asked us to go back home, come back later. And for us, later didn't happen.
I found when I was watching the documentary that I felt like we were 2 weeks in and then suddenly it'd be like 4 days in to Katrina. And I found that kind of fascinating. All that did unfold. Because once you kind of, in the aftermath of the storm, everyone kind of breathes a sigh of relief, you know, at the start of the documentary. Oh, guys, we made it through. And then obviously we discovered the grim truth of what happened to the black community of New Orleans.
I think the thing about this is, and what it, why it's so important, is the fact that it brings it back to the personal and it brings it back to the people all the time. And especially with the Spike Lee part of it, because it is just testimony from people and their experiences. And when you hear somebody say they had the National Guard on the streets pointing guns at citizens, and across the city there was 35 OAPs who were left to drown, to perish, it actually does something to you. And it means something. It's meaningful. You see a woman talking about her child who should be 25 years old, who's dead. You see Robert Greene, who there, as we're talking about, is looking after his mother. His mother ends up dying. His granddaughter ends up dying. And you're like, and it's just impossible to see a wealthy country like America do this to their own citizens. And they say suddenly there is enough people to take care of the looting, but not enough people to help those in need. And where are they? And this is it. And I think that's why the Spike Lee part of it is so important, because it's a visceral anger to this, and it should be. It's America's shame.
Yeah, absolutely. And let's talk about Brad Pitt. He was the darling of the media when he set out to help the communities in New Orleans affected by Katrina, but his efforts have not stood the test of time. Chris, what's your take?
Oh, well, I wasn't familiar
The Make It Right project was when Brad Pitt was rocking up to his beloved New Orleans and to help out, and he was having this new affordable, sustainable housing, apparently. And the Make It Right project had Robert Greene kind of as the face of it, and he was one of the main spokesperson, and it felt like this liberal utopia. But when the cameras kind of stopped rolling and the news moved on, the celebrities walked away and they left these people in homes that were just not built properly. And some of them are completely unlivable. And you see that they were offered these very, you know, cheap mortgages, but now they have to pay over and above the odds. They're paying, you know, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, even more to get these homes fixed. And you have to ask, why were celebrities helping in the first place? Where was the government? And I think this is also important.
That's fair.
About what Spike Lee is doing, because he's saying, at this time, we're on social media pointing fingers at each other all the time, saying, you're getting my job, you're getting my house. Where does the problem stem from? We shouldn't be fighting against each other. It's about ask who holds those purse strings.
Okay. All right. Okay, Chris and Jen, you're going to stay with me. That is Katrina, Come Hell and High Water. It's on Netflix now. It's 3 episodes. We'll be back after this quick break. You're listening to Arena. I still have Chris Foster and Jen Gannon in studio with me. We're going to talk about The Guest tonight. So we have a new drama. It's on BBC One. It's a 4-part thriller about a toxic relationship between a wealthy businesswoman and her cleaner. And this series, it doesn't begin until Monday, so we're only going to be previewing this one tonight. Chris, can you set this one up for us?
Yeah, so we are following a girl named Rhea, played by Gabrielle Creevy, who could do with a bit of a break, to be honest. It's been a while since anyone looked out for her. She's 20-something years old. She works as a cleaner. She lives with her completely useless boyfriend, played by the brilliant Sion Daniel Young. And while she's cleaning people's houses and being told that she should be doing it for a lower price around in Wales they live, he spends all of his days on his games console. So we meet her at the beginning in an upmarket grocery store where she's being humiliated by a security guard. She's trying to make use of the donation bins there. And the only person who calls her out on this, or the security guard out on this, is a woman named Fran Sharp, played by Eve Miles.
And we have a clip. So this clip sees Fran, sees Rhea trying to take some items from a charity basket and follows her outside. Eve Miles is Fran and Gabrielle Creevy is Rhea.
Bit of a twat, wasn't he? Napoleon complex, isn't that what they call it? Angry little men. Francesca, Fran,
Rhea.
Hi, Rhea.
Napoleon wasn't a little man.
Excuse me?
He wasn't short. It's a myth, apparently.
Oh. My last cleaner, Anna, she was wonderful. Ended up moving away. Well, I've been stuck with an agency. They're not good.
Right.
You're a cleaner, right?
I don't need charity.
No, no, it's not charity. And it be a trial shift, not a job. But pay well. I promise you that. Have to think about it. Bye-bye. Bye.
Okay, so Jen, the BBC calls this a psychological game of cat and mouse. Does this sum it up or is it something more?
It's strange. In a word, you can see where the showrunner, Matthew Barry, is going. Like you know that he's a fan of those kind of 90s thrillers like Pacific Heights, The Hand That Rocks the Cradle, Single White Female. Like they were playing on the yuppie neurosis, amongst other things. That's what they were trying to do, about the other half wanting to keep the status quo and then these imposters, strange imposters encroaching on their space. The guest is at pains to draw out themes like that, I think. It's not exactly subtle. And no, it's a bit wobbly. Like the guest is shot with these swooping camera work, mm-hmm. and it's a bit rickety, the set design. It can sometimes feel like the 70s mm-hmm. Tales of the Unexpected, yeah. For me.
I found it like, I've watched the first episode and I found it like a little bit cringy and a little bit uncomfortable to watch, but that's kind of what they want.
I think that
it
might be intentional a little bit, yeah, because Gabrielle Creevy, especially in the run up to this, has been talking, maybe like pushing slightly the horror element of it and saying, oh, this show has lots of jump scares in it. And you would think, you know, from the first half an hour, okay, this is kind of, you know, soapy kitchen sink melodrama, but then something happens, and we're not going to spoil what it is, but something happens where, you know, Rhea is no longer just, you know, the cleaner working for Fran. They all of a sudden have information on each other and they kind of need to stay in one another's lives to, you know, make sure that they're yeah. okay. And that's something that happens is there was a little bit of Stephen King, Stanley Kubrick in it. So I'm not going to give anything away, but it is absolutely bananas.
Mm. All is not what it seems.
All is not what it seems. And yeah, Matthew Barry, who wrote this, he has come out and said that he is a big fan of 90s thrillers like the one that Jen's mentioned. And I think he has intentionally designed something that going into it, you think, well, this is going to be fairly straightforward, but then you come out and go, what was that?
Yeah,
so I think
that's
it is
kind of how I feel after the first episode. So as this is a preview, we're not going to give any stars out tonight, but is it worth tuning in very quickly?
I think so.
I mean, there's something there. There's the essence of something there, and it will keep you watching.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah. Okay. Well cast too. Yeah.
Okay, brilliant. Jen, Chris, thank you both so much for chatting to me this evening. And now, in just a few short years, Dunboyne's Diana CMAT has gone from live streams and lockdown to winning the Choice Music Prize, selling out international tours and stepping onto the Glastonbury Pyramid Stage. Now, with her third album, Euro Country, she doubles down on her blend of satire and sincerity, and she's pushing country pop into bolder territory while still mining the chaos and vulnerability that made her a star. Sabrina Carpenter's seventh studio album, Man's Best Friend, arrives at the peak of a whirlwind few years, which has seen her evolve from Disney Channel actress to global pop powerhouse following her breakthrough 2024 album, Short and Sweet, and global hits like Espresso and Please, Please, Please. So Carpenter now turns her attention to a deeply personal breakup album. And finally, Swedish garage punk stalwarts The Hives return with The Hives Forever, Forever The Hives, nearly three decades after their debut, and the band becomes emblematic of the early 2000s rock resurgent, known for punchy anthems like Hate to Say I Told You So and Tick Tick Boom. And their latest album is produced by longtime collaborator Pelle Gunderfelt, with input from Mike D from the Beastie Boys and Josh Home from Queens of the Stone Age. And I'm delighted to be joined by Sarah Hederman and Keane Sullivan. It's lovely to have you guys. It is like a royal occasion in Ireland. The album that we've all been waiting for, it's Euro Country, it's CMAT. Are we both excited about it?
Yes, really excited.
Yeah, Zara?
I actually was in the minority of, I wasn't a huge CMAT fan, but this album has really kind of changed my perspective on her music. Mm-hmm. Have always really appreciated her amazing ability for an earworm.
Yeah.
And that's abundant here.
Okay, well, CMAT has risen at breakneck speed. As I said, Choice Prize winner, Ivor Novello nominee, Sam Fender's tour operator, the nation's sweetheart. And now she delivers her most anticipated record yet. So, Zara, how well does Euro Country reflect the scale of her success so far?
Kind of very well. And like, I think like a huge thing with this album that I was really taken by was this is her third album in the space of 3 years. Like, she's working really well, really quickly. And I have to say, her like exhaustive touring, she's constantly on the road, constantly playing, as you mentioned, on Glastonbury as well. I feel like that element to her artistry has massively informed this, because the songs are so much bigger and she's doing so much more with the arrangements that are so serving to her band, having fun within the arrangements and also for crowd participation. As I said, like, her choruses have always been massive, but I feel even more so on this. And even after one or two listens of this album, I was on the couch singing along. So
yeah,
that's the kind of strength. She knows what her audience wants. She knows what her strengths are as well. Mm-hmm. And that is in like, as well, just the cultural references. Like you mentioned earlier as well, the Dumbo and Diana. Here alone, we have, we've got Gwyneth Paltrow. We've the Jamie Oliver petrol station. There's a reference to Titanic in one line. She calls herself, or she says she feels like Cú Chulainn and feels like Carrie Katona. So there's so much for people to latch on to.
I never thought I'd listen to a song that would have Cú Chulainn and Carrie Katona in the same sentence.
Yeah, there you go. That's the magic of her. And the way she can kind of convey her emotions, you know, very earnestly, and, you know, I think she could really bring you in emotionally, and then she'll like make you laugh with a cultural reference as well. And I think something that I find really fascinating about her is, and sometimes you hear her and you wonder, you kind of wish she's okay. I think there's a lot of sort of authentic unwellness sometimes in her music where, you know, she's not showing you the best side of herself. She's willing to open up about sort of things where she's maybe not behaving in the best way, or, you know, she's showing her vulnerability. And I think like something about Sima is so telling is she can say the most like self-hating line, but she'll deliver it as a pun. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's so witty and clever like
mm-hmm.
that.
And what I loved about this was I was listening to the album today and this song stuck out to me. Lord, Let That Tesla Crash. Let's have a listen.
Let's go back to the dog. How he almost made me.
Now that was Lord, Let That Tesla Crash, and we're seeing a very emotional and vulnerable Seamat, would you say, Keane?
Absolutely. I think she's never sounded better. That song is an ode to a friend who has passed away. You can hear the kind of Simon and Garfunkel lilting ballad. The way her falsetto, so haunting, swoops in and out of those run-on lines. I think she's part Emmylou Harris, part Kate Bush. And I think what's really great is, you know, from the outside looking in, being someone who watched her do a live stream eating 80-piece chicken bucket to promote her first single on a live stream, to seeing her now, she is absolutely knuckled down into being truly herself. You know, even in the musical form, songs are getting shorter and shorter, attention spans getting shorter and shorter. The shortest song on this album is 3.5 minutes. You know, she's really happy to play with form. And the thing is, those songs, that song there, Tesla, is over 5 minutes long. It doesn't feel like it because she's such a great storyteller. She just sweeps you up in it. And I think that's what's really, really great about her songwriting.
And that's the thing about Seamat as well. She seems to kind of thrive against industry trends. You know, longer songs, viral verses instead of choruses, intricate storytelling. And how do you think this defiance contributes to her appeal? Do you think it contributes, or do you think it takes away from her?
I definitely think it contributes to her as well.
What do you think, Sarah? Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely think so. I mean, even when we were listening to that song, Lord, Let That Tesla Crash, like, we were all silent and very attentive to it. And I think that that was something I was very struck by, especially with that song, which was a highlight for me, is that she has such a skill in her songwriting of really drawing you in and wanting to know what she's saying. And as you said, like, when she does talk about like her insecurities and her frustrations with herself, it's not in that kind of generic language we hear quite a lot in songs, they use blanket terms. Like, she goes into big detail. Like, she has a song later, Coronation Street, where she like talks about spending all her money on things that keep me tired, give me bingo wings that can't fly but keep me up all night. Like, that's the kind of honesty that we don't get a lot in pop.
Do you know what? Let's have a listen to Coronation Street. That was Coronation Street, and I was listening to that today and I was just thinking how emotive the lyrics were, but then I laughed. Bingo wings that cannot fly. Mm. Like, she has this ability to make you laugh and kind of cry in the same song. And Keane, you were saying earlier, she does seem to bend genres from Shania Twain, you know, to kind of Fiona Apple-esque piano work. Do these shifts feel organic now at this stage, or do you think, are they a part of a deliberate bid for kind of wider recognition? I've been called Ireland's Dolly Parton.
Yeah. I mean, I know she kind of gets lumped in with country, but I've always felt country was more of a perspective for her than it was a really strong album signifier. Yeah, you know, like you said, there's Fiona Apple in here, there's Pulp in here, and Jamie Oliver, Petrol Station, Shania Twain, but none of them really feel like they're out of her range. I think what's really great about her is because her personality and her point of view is so strong, she can adapt to whatever she wants.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love Janis Joplin as well, the last track on the album. I thought that was really beautiful. And I work in radio, so I've been listening to Running, Planning, Take a Sexy Picture, Euro Country. It was just so refreshing to hear all of these new songs and to get another level of her. And I want to play Iceberg now, just for you to get a little bit of a hint of that. That was Iceberg, another gorgeous track from the album. So I'm going to put it to you now, guys. Favourite songs from the album?
For me, it was Lord, Let That Tesla Crash. I really liked it when she was in the kind of more spacious, more mournful kind of mode on this album, except for Euro Country. And actually, lyrically as well, Euro Country was a song on it that I was more interested in because she's dealing with political kind of Ireland's government. She has mentions of like brown envelopes, ghost estates, grave effects that the financial crash had on people. And I was interested to hear more from her on that. That was the kind of only song where we really got that. So that was a bit, not a disappointment for this album, but definitely something to look forward to, I think, with the next album.
Okay, and Keane, what do you think?
I loved Iceberg there. I think it has a perfect, you know, phone light in the air at a festival, really easy chorus to sing along if someone doesn't know it. And it's the only song that gave me goosebumps. It's for her friend who's having a tough time and she's there to support. And of course, because it seemed like it's woven through a Titanic, you know, analogy.
So, absolutely. Yeah, it's my favorite. Speaking of festivals, do you think she's going to make an appearance at Electric Picnic this weekend?
Oh, and she was in Belfast, was she recently? So she's
around.
She is around.
Okay. Finally, do you think that she has found her most confident artistic voice yet?
I do, yeah. I think there is definitely some songs that were left over from the previous album, but I do think the songs that show a new strand to her artistry are really confident and they're really assured. Okay. And I really hope it's the way forward.
Keane, what do you think?
Totally agree. I think we could have risked her becoming more streamlined as she got more successful, and she hasn't.
Okay,
this
brilliant.
Is her best work yet.
So how many stars?
For me, 5.
I loved it.
Yeah. I'm going to go with 3.5 because while there was some great moments on here, I just felt that this album was so great, but it still felt a bit kind of locked to the previous two albums. And I just wanted some more, especially the political kind of leanings of her lyrics, because I thought she did that very well on Euro Country.
Okay, brilliant. Sarah Keane, stay with me. We're going to take a quick break. On the way, we're going to talk about Sabrina Carpenter's new album and The Hives. You are listening to Arena, and I'm joined in studio by Zara and Keane, and we're going to talk about Sabrina Carpenter's new album came out today, Man's Best Friend. So Zara, how does Sabrina Carpenter, how does her evolution from Disney star to pop a provocateur shape the theme of Man's Best Friend?
It doesn't really shape it too much. I would say the thing that really shapes this album is the foreshadowing she had on her single Please, 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 where she was begging her partner, as we know is Barry Keoghan at the time.
Kind of cringing for him a little bit, but anyway.
Yeah, I would. If I was him, I wouldn't be listening to this album today, that's for sure. So definitely they had their breakup, I think at the end of last year, wasn't it?
And she'd look at me for that.
Yeah. So they had their breakup, so that very much informs this album. And what I will say that's carried on from Short and Sweet, her 6th album that came out last year. And I think a lot of people were very surprised that that was her 6th one.
Absolutely.
Because she just came out of nowhere from supporting Taylor Swift on the Eras tour to then releasing Espresso to then breaking so many records as well with her songs. So she's working again with Jack Antonoff and Amy Allen, who's like such a huge, hugely successful pop writer. So they are continuing to genre blend, which she did quite a lot with Short and Sweet. But instead, this time she's turned her focus to, like, say, 70s disco, kind of mournful 70s pop rock, some 80s in there. There's a few, like, Paula Abdul-esque songs. And then what I found kind of interesting was, obviously, Jack Antonoff has worked with so many
people.
He's
a brilliant producer, yeah.
Yeah. One thing I found very shocking, I would say, is the carryover of maybe some of the things he did with Taylor Swift on this.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Well, if you think about it, if she did go on tour with Taylor Swift and then she did, you know, she did have a huge rise, that doesn't surprise me.
It just surprised me in the way that, you know, she's so massive right now. People are so listening to her so intently. And then to have a song, it's towards the end, what is it called? Don't Worry, I'll Make You Worry, where it just sounds like a folklore song that was Jack was like, oh, we didn't get to use this. Maybe I'll bring this into a Sabrina project.
Well, if you've got any spare songs hanging about.
Absolutely, yeah.
Why not? Keane, does the genre hopping across the record enhance her storytelling and vocal strengths, or do you think it dilutes her artistic identity?
I actually think the genre hopping is a bit of a mask. I think what was amazing about Short and Sweet was this really goofy, horny jokes and puns that she would make. You know, this woman is not afraid to talk about her sexuality. And, you know, I think there was a lot of controversy around the album artwork for this, if I can mention it briefly.
Yes.
You know, it's her in a very provocative position. The internet ate itself about arguments about whether it was feminism or not. And I wonder whether, just due to the backlash, she's kind of toned down on the goofiness and the sex puns. I kind of feel this is more about romantic frustration. And I wonder then, I feel like both melodically, there's kind of less ear candy for me. I also feel like the characterization is less. And I do wonder whether, you know, zipping between Y2K, Christina Aguilera and, you know, Paula Abdul and Dolly Parton is kind of a disguise for that.
Okay, well, look, why don't we have a listen to a track? Here is Manchild. That was Manchild. I think that's like a perfect pop bop.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I can hear that on the radio and I can hear it. You know what I mean? It's fun.
Yeah, that's what she does so best. These short, compact, glowy,
like herself,
sparkly. Yeah, short and sweet, sparkly pop songs. And there's the gallop in that song is what gets me after the chorus. The kind of da-da-dum, da-da-dum. Love that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And do you know what? To what extent, Sarah, does the lyrical content, like ranging from the breakup lament to tongue-in-cheek sexual humour, does it reveal a maturing artistic voice? I don't think.
Not really.
I don't think you're sold, yeah.
No, not really. Like, there were lines that I was, like, tickled by. I don't really know if they're appropriate even for the radio, but my mom is listening, so I won't. But it just felt a bit too samey. Like, I think, because this album has followed so soon after Short and Sweet, I feel like it would be beneficial for her to go away for maybe a year, 18 months and kind of remove herself and come back and like wow us again. Because that was what like last year was for her. She was like wowing everyone with like the big songs, the tongue-in-cheekness, even like stuff like her slant rhyming system within her song, which was very clever in her lyrics. But this just felt very, I don't even want to say rush job, but it, like Keane was saying, it's wearing a mask. And even with Manchild, I love that song and I laugh so much listening to it. But I always just think it, immediately it's a Chapel Rowan song.
See, this is it. When I was listening to it today, and if I didn't know it was Sabrina Carpenter,
yeah,
I would have had to really think hard on which American artist this is right now.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Absolutely.
And you're so right, because it did remind me of Chapel Rowan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And even I remember the first time hearing the song, I kind of grimaced a bit because I was like, oh, she's just immediately trying to do what is not trendy now, but she's kind of falling back on what people are liking. And it's maybe a lack of confidence or something in her own ability, or it's wanting to kind of keep her position in the conversation because pop is having such a big moment at the moment.
But it's so interesting what you both said, because you mentioned a song on the album being like a song that should have been on Folklore by Taylor Swift, for example. We know she's one of the biggest pop stars in the world. And you also mentioned Chapel Rowan. So maybe this album is doing exactly what it intends to do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think what Sarah's saying is, I think she's definitely sticking in her wheelhouse. Mm. And there's a lot of people in that house and they're not going to like it. Oh. But I think after this one, we need to see something slightly different.
Something different. Okay. You're going to let her get away with this one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just about.
Okay. Just about.
Do we have any favourite songs from this?
I really loved When Did You Get Hot? It was her little like whiplash glow up of a guy she went to school with. And it feels like it's Christina Aguilera's Stripped album. I really liked that.
Okay, do you know what? Why don't we hear a little bit of that? When Did You Get Hot? Congratulations on your new improvements. I bet your light rod's like bigger than Zeus's. Okay, so that was When Did You Get Hot? And You know, in fairness, the two of us were bopping away in studio to that.
Yeah.
I was saying to Zara, it reminds me, do you remember the Christina Aguilera and Lil' Kim song Can't Hold Us Down?
Yes.
Yeah. That's what that gave me.
All right. Okay. Well, maybe all is not lost. Sorry. Do you have any favourite songs?
I actually quite like We Almost Broke Up Again Last Night, which reminded me a little bit of The Carpenters and Juice Newton, that song Angel of the Morning.
Oh, yeah.
So I quite liked actually that element of when she was doing a genre hop, she wasn't necessarily going to like the most obvious places. She even has like a very fuzzed guitar riff in that, which is very like The Carpenters' Goodbye to Love. But aside from that, Manchild was my favourite, which as the first single and the opening track is not a great thing for a big pop album.
I liked Tears.
Yes.
Yeah,
Disco. Tears is, an interesting one. So out of how many stars have we given Sabrina Carpenter's Man's Best Friend?
I am giving it a 2.5 because I just was quite disappointed. And I was saying to Keen earlier, these songs just didn't lodge in my head as quickly as the ones on Short and Sweet did.
Okay.
I'm a more generous 3.5. I think it's a solid 7 out of 10. All definitely right. A lot to enjoy.
Okay, Keen, that is fair. All right, let's move on now. The Hives. The Hives forever, forever, The Hives. So how do you see The Hives forever, forever, The Hives balancing the band's legacy sound with attempts at contemporary commentary, Zara?
It hasn't really changed a whole lot since 2004, which I actually kind of loved, I have to say. Like, they weren't always a band I thought about quite a lot, but they're always around because they're in so many ads, so many video games like Gran Turismo, FIFA, and then also just like in every film from that era as well. And I found it, I was a bit hesitant, I'm not going to lie, going into this album, especially with the opening track, Enough is Enough, where they try their hand at being political, and it's just a bit maybe Green Day in 2020 trying to get you, like, it was just a bit juvenile, their takes on it.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to that. That is Enough is Enough, and just to be aware, there's some strong language in this clip. I'd imagine there might be people out there feeling the exact same, that enough is enough, because there's a little bit of a buzz of a you know, your mates in a band, you know, in secondary school, you know, off that particular song. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And like, I think like that was something with this album. Like, I feel like the first time I heard it, I was maybe a bit unfair to it. And I think there's a song later on called something like People Can't Hear It Anymore. And I was like, I really kind of wish this was my experience. I wish I couldn't hear this anymore. But then I was like, no, I'm being unfair. I'm sitting like at a desk with headphones on. This isn't the scenario for this. It's a live album to hear.
Okay, Keen, what's your take on it?
Yeah, I kind of totally agree. And I know we just ragged on Sabrina Carpenter for keeping it the same, but I kind of feel like these guys are just defining, just giving us the same stuff, and they don't really care. It reminds you of classic Swedish pop music, which is just strong melody, emotional simplicity, and minimalist aesthetic. They're choosing a rock sound and they're going for it. They're very simple ideas, and I think they're just giving you an array of rock sounds that you're going to enjoy in a live set.
Okay, very quickly, how many stars are we giving them?
I'm giving it a 2 because there was just, I'm not going to be at a live gig listening to them all the time. Okay. Even though I can see the mosh pits, I can feel the sweat, there just wasn't enough to bring me back to listen to it casually.
Okay, Keen?
I went for 3. The head was bopping, the toe was tapping. Will I come back to it? Not sure.
Well, there you go. Keen and Zara, thank you so much for joining me in studio today. My name is Ciara King. I'll be back in Arena on Monday. Tonight's programme was produced by Sheila O'Callaghan. Our broadcast coordinator was Ollie Hamilton, and Paul Murdoch was in sound.